Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hi, and welcome to New Books and Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kellen McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Each month or so, I interview an author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Fatma Mugay-Gocek to the show. Longtime listeners may recognize her name. A couple years ago, I interviewed Ramsey about the book A Question of Genocide, Armenians and Turks at the End of the Ottoman Empire, and Mugay was a co-editor on that book. I didn't get a chance to talk with her then, but I'm excited to be able to rectify that today. And today we're going to talk about her new book, Denial of Violence, Ottoman Past, Turkish Present, and Collective Violence Against the Armenians, 1789 to 2009. The book is a thoughtful, intellectually rigorous, and at the same time intensely personal examination of the way in which violence against the minorities in Turkey and the Ottoman Empire, especially Armenians, has been obscured and denied over the past 125 years. It presents a well-thought-out theory of denial, but it does so in prose that makes good use of the personal observations of hundreds of memoirists. It's a fascinating book, and I'm thrilled to be able to talk with Mugay about it today. So, with that, Mugay, thanks for being with us in New Books and Genocide Studies, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't we start out the way we usually do on the show, and I'll ask you just to tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be interested in the subject of your book.
Sure. I was born and raised in Istanbul, Turkey. After I went to Robert College, which is an American high school, and Bosphorus University after that, where I received a BA and MA in sociology in English, the language of instruction is in English. Then I applied for a PhD program. Here in the United States, and ended up at Princeton, where I got my PhD. And after that, I have been a faculty member at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, since then. In terms of what interests me and how I ended up studying this particular topic, I was initially, the fact that I was in Turkey in the late 1970s and 80s, early 1980s, when the student movement and unrest there was at its height, had something to do with it. I initially was going to be a business major and follow the family profession because they're all business people. But when I started seeing all the conflict around me, I said I couldn't in good conscience make money when the society was falling apart, and therefore I first switched, much to my father's distress, into the social sciences. And then after that, I had a hard time deciding between social psychology and sociology, but I thought that it would be more interesting to look at things at the societal perspective, and that's why I ended up in sociology, and my father, he said that, because I was a girl, I sort of could do whatever I want. Unlike, if I had been a son, there would have been much more pressure for me, probably, to do something more profitable or, more income-worthy. So that is how I started working. I tried to understand what was going on in the Turkish society and why there was so much unrest. And I thought at the time that it was very contentious and conflictual to try to look at things in the contemporary era. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, why don't I look into the origins, the roots of all of this unrest? I thought that would be much safer politically. And therefore, I decided to look at the way in which Turkey interacted with the West because at that time, the reigning paradigms were that, you know, we couldn't understand why Turkey couldn't become a capitalist country, a successful country like Japan or other countries. So that was why I thought I should look at the way in which Turkey interacted with the West. That is, the Ottoman Empire interacted mm-hmm. with the West. And because of that, my master's thesis when I was at Boğaziçi University was actually a study of the Ottoman population transfer policies in the early Ottoman era. And then for my dissertation, I looked at the westernization process. That ended up in a book called The Rise of the Bourgeoisie, Demise of Empire, Ottoman Westernization and Social Change. And there I was looking at, you know, how Ottomans interacted with the West. And during, while I was a graduate student, actually, I wrote another book which sort of led to the dissertation that was on East Encounters West, it was called, and how it was on the first Ottoman embassy that was sent to France with the intent in the 1720s, with the intent to observe, you know, Western ways of doing things and then recommend what to do about them back home. So after, you know, dabbling in the West, I wrote my dissertation, as I said, on it, and I then became a faculty member at the University of Michigan, and the book came out, and it was fine. And what I had observed in that book was that towards the end of the Ottoman Empire, what happened was that there had been a bourgeoisie that was created in the Ottoman context, but these were mostly non-Muslim economic bourgeoisie. They were very important in trade, commerce, and, you know, a lot of the activities that the bourgeoisie engage in. And I realized that with the establishment of the Turkish Republic, they all met their demise one way or the other.
Hmm.
The Jewish were small in numbers, and they eventually became replaced by Muslim Turkish bourgeoisie. The Greek bourgeoisie were actually had to leave, mostly forced, and later through a population exchange for Greece. And for the Armenian bourgeoisie, they were, of course, liquidated through massacres and violence. And that always had me ask the question, what would have happened if we hadn't gone through that liquidation? How would Turkey have come to be? What kinds of advantages or disadvantages we would have had, or disadvantages, if that had continued? So that was always in the back of my mind. And after I finished my book, I was supposed to write a second, of course, book. At the time, I thought I would write on the Islamist movement, because Islam for the first time was becoming a significant political force in Turkey. And I went and interviewed many of the leaders, including, the former president and other prominent members of the Justice and Development Party, or what became the Justice and Development Party later. At the time, there was still tension between them and the military with coups and everything. So whenever I came back to the United States and talked about my research about, you know, social change and the Islamist movement in Turkey, they told me that I'd much rather study the military rather than the party, because obviously it was the military that was, you know, controlled and changed. And I thought it would be unwise for me to study the military, because nobody did. But what interested me then, I said, well, why is it that the Turkish society in general is so accepting of coups? I mean, because military coups are another form of violence. They are a political, they're basically politically violent. And, they undermine democracy, yet Turkish society has no problem welcoming them one after another. And I said, how could it be that violence has been normalized in Turkish society so much? Why are we so accepting of what goes on? And I said, there must be an initial violence, a foundational violence that happened that we never accounted for, that became a part and parcel of what we were, what we have become. And because of that, I started looking back to see, you know, what is the foundation of violence. And I had to obviously stop at 1915, 1917, and the Armenian genocide. That's how I arrived at it. And of course, that also intersected very nicely with the lesson I had sort of learned from the book I wrote on the bourgeoisie. And I said, well, what happened and how did it impact happened later? And for me, the issue was never whether this was a genocide or not. It was evident to me by the research I did that it was indeed genocide, not only for the destruction carried out then, but also later on, the destruction carried on through denial, which is considered, the last stage of genocide. And because of that, I was much more interested in why Turkish state and society deny what happened. Mm-hmm. To me, that was a much more interesting question because it would hopefully make me understand why it was so difficult for Turkey to transition into a truly democratic society that is at peace with its own past. And that's how it all started.
That's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
And I have to confess, I suspect graduate students listening to this, you've struck fear into their heart now that they've learned that you actually published a book as a graduate student and that they're afraid they will have to do the same thing. There's a lot of there's a way in which your personal journey of exploration is intertwined with this book, and I want to hold off on that for a little bit, but come back to it. So let's start talking about the argument of the book now, and you start out by laying out an approach to studying denial that understands it as a process with both structural and effective components. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Sure. When I started studying this, very important instance of violence, during the genocide, either 1915 to 17 or 1915 to 22, my other question as a sociologist was, what would be the starting point of my study and what would be the end point? The starting point, I said, well, were there other instances of violence against the Armenians prior to the genocide? And there were indeed. And that's why I kept going back and back. And, I ended up in 1789 because, not because of the, fortuitous year when the French Revolution occurred, but it was also the year in which Sultan Selim III came to the throne in the Ottoman Empire and started systematic modernization of the empire. And modernity, like Zygmunt Bauman and Hannah Arendt and others have argued, I thought, really polarized relations in society. And that's why I thought I would start in 1789. And then I said, well, has then the violence against the Armenians abated after the genocide? And no, it hadn't. And I had to therefore bring it up to date, and I had to stop at 2009 because it was a nice round number up somewhere. And that's how it came about. And when you look at it, usually in terms of change, whenever change happens, there are very important structural factors, factors, as I said, introduced by modernity. But when you look at many societies, not all instances of violence turn into genocide. I mean, they are usually contained in the system in one way or another. And I said, well, what is it that sort of leads, triggers violence of this? Because violence is sort of destroying or bringing harm onto others, is a next step that one takes. It is a very dramatic step. And thankfully, in our history of humankind, we don't have too many such steps. So for me, that's how the affective element or the emotions come into play. I think that the sort of the polarized society, you know, people feeling sort of uneasy towards one another, they could live like that forever, usually. But, you know, what triggers that step of violence? That is why I brought in the emotional, because there is sort of collective emotions that lead to that. For example, if you think about our own society here in the United States, you know, with Ferguson or with the murders in North Carolina of the Muslims, I mean, it's interesting that the collective emotions that have emerged in both cases were those defending, the victims, and, you know, at least saying as a society, we are conscientious, we know what happened, we condemn it, and we don't want it to happen again. I mean, that is a very important message. If in its stead, nobody had talked about it, people had justified what they were saying, I think what we would have seen would have been an escalation of violence. And, you know, that demonstrates, I think, the significance of collective display of emotions in one way or another. And that is why I looked at the interaction of structural factors brought upon by modernity, economic, political, and the social, with emotional factors, collective feelings, public opinion, and the things, that produced.
And your main, or one of your main set of sources for this study are memoirs, a really quite astonishingly large number of them. How did you find all of these?
Well, that's why the book took 12 years to write. Because until then, people have always, scholars have, and to this day, use mostly official documents. And of course, official documents are important, but critical theory also tells us, especially, you know, race theory, queer theory, and feminist theory that, you know, I learn and teach, they tell us that they too have obviously vested interest in them, and they are the interests of the state. And especially since I wanted to bring in the effect of the emotions, there weren't going to be too many emotions in these, in these official documents. And more importantly, you don't hear the people's voices, be they victims or perpetrators. And that's why I said, you know, how can I capture that? And a memoir, I mean, there were a couple of things. I could have done oral histories, but that wasn't very advisable, both because, of course, not many people have survived. And, of course, if they have, talking to them, you know, given that genocide is not accepted in Turkey, would have been quite challenging. Mm-hmm. Another factor, source could have been literature. I mean, you know, fiction is a very important source that could be demonstrated, but that could be employed to demonstrate violence. But there is not enough fiction systematically, especially including, the minority fiction in Turkey, enough for me to undertake that such a thing systematically. So I said, why not memoirs? I mean, and that's how I ended up. And they had been published, all throughout Turkish Republican history. I looked at the ones after 1928. So I only looked at the ones written in Latin script, even though I do know Ottoman script. But I figured these had to be all available to Turkish society in one form or another. And it was important that society did not draw upon these and see the violence for themselves, but denied it instead. So I started reading all the memoirs I could get my hands on, both, through the booksellers in Turkey, libraries here, libraries all over the world, and read probably about 700-800 of them. All those, I then, well, it was fun. I what can I say? And I only chose the ones that had some information on violence, minorities, you know, in one form or another. I then took notes. I was brought up bilingually, so I can use Turkish and English interchangeably. I mean, it's easy for me. So I took all my notes in English because I thought it, I mean, I translated all the Turkish memoirs into English as I was taking the notes. And then I had about 1,000 pages single-spaced of notes. And once you have that, because we have the computer now, it's so easy.
Yeah.
Because if you only have one memoir, or if you have like typical five memoirs, they usually can be very idiosyncratic and sort of take you in one direction or another. But if you end up having, you know, 300 plus memoirs, you do start seeing patterns, and they do balance each other out. And it's like a jigsaw puzzle, literally, where you can put all the pieces together, and you can even get life stories of people by computer searching, I mean, the keywords and everything. And it, I think, makes you sort of, you know, more cognizant of the time and how people saw it. And it also gave me a sense of, you know, what were the turning points where, you know, in terms of the violence against the Armenians, at least the narrators had. And most of these narrators, about 80% of them, were perpetrators of one sort or another. And that was also very unique because such violence often combined with nationalism, ethnic nationalism. Initially, they were not, some of them had no problem writing about it. Others self-censored, but if you read it against the grain, let go of it in certain ways, so that by bringing these all together, I could narrate, and I argued, you know, there were stages, basically four stages through which this whole denial process came to be.
And just again, for those graduate students who might be listening and are now having a heart attack at the words 12 years and 700 memoirs, I do want to point out she said the words interesting and fun in that answer as well. It's easier to do that after the book is done, I'm sure, than when it's happening, but it is. But I have to testify, I'm fun and interesting are words that come to my mind in research as well. You talked about four periods, and the first one you outline runs in the book from 1789 to 1907. But the violence that you study doesn't really begin in earnest until later in the period. So what happens during that period that creates this the emergence of violence?
I think two things are very important. Until then, you know, before the emergence of this violence, in the millet system that, in a way, protected the minorities in the Ottoman Empire was very important in that, you know, there was a lot of communal monitoring that went on, you know, with these non-Muslim communities. And also the Sultan sort of provided protection over the leader of the community, through the leader of the community, to the entire community. And usually, therefore, when there were instances of violence against the non-Muslims, they were either, you know, brought to the attention of the Sultan and, you know, the state by either the non-Muslim leaders or by the Muslims, you know, living in that place. And they all worked together to contain it, to make sure that whoever engaged in that violence would be punished. So accountability becomes extremely important in this story. They were held accountable. Usually the elders would get together and then go and talk to the people, usually younger people who, of course, were more prone to engage in violence, and they would tell them to chill and, you know, take it easy and then, yeah, either work and somehow compensate those. What happens, of course, with modernity is that, as Will Kimbichka talks about, the basis of protection changes from communal to individual. And once you do provide protection at the individual basis, the assumption that there is all the individuals are equal to one another. Well, that's extremely hard to carry out, and non-Muslims were never equal, you know, because of all the rights and responsibilities they had in the empire. They were never equal to the Muslims. As a consequence, it became much harder to monitor this at a one-on-one scale. And once the non-Muslims also started then experiencing violence, they were not protected in the same way. Not only were they not protected, the other people around also saw that there was not this protection, and also there was not a punishment for the crime or the violence they committed. And that is the sort of change you start seeing towards the 1890s, especially after a series of reforms in 1839, 56, 76 failed to protect the non-Muslims at the same level as the Muslims. And the failure of those reforms and the increasing, defeat of the empire, especially with respect to the Russian wars fought against Russia in 56 and 78, 1856 and 78, have a lot to do with the first instance of violence in the first period.
So how extensive was the violence against Armenians and other non-Muslims in the late 1800s, early 1900s?
Well, the ones that we do have, 1894, 96 or thereabouts, they say anywhere from 100 to 300,000, Armenians were killed. And it's very interesting because most of them, the deaths actually occurred in Eastern Anatolia. And that was where in 1850, you know, there was private property law where that, you know, you had to title your land and get a deed for it. That caused a lot of unrest because it was the same period where they were also trying to get Kurds to settle down. And what happened, of course, is that they were nomads before, and they would settle down, but often at the expense of the Armenians. And that is why there is a lot of impoverishment of Armenians there, even though if you look at what's going on in western parts of the empire, in the major cities, Armenians who trade with the West are becoming very rich. The interesting thing is the Sultan says it's okay for the Armenians to become rich insofar as they do not translate their economic wealth into political power, so that they have to stay apolitical. That's why the west of the empire is filled with mostly, you know, Istanbul, they call us Bulis Armenians, you know, Armenians of the capital who are wealthy but who are apolitical, compared to the eastern parts of the empire where they are more impoverished. And what's interesting is, of course, more impoverished and because of that much more prone to become politicized. And that is, I think, also significant that the divide within the Armenian community itself in that way also, in a way, made it difficult for them to act as a community again, to take a stand against the violence as well. And that is why most of the violence started in the eastern provinces against, the tax collectors, the Muslims. And what happened was that Abdülhamid was extremely worried about Western foreign intervention in the affairs of the empire, and therefore he sent troops. He didn't send troops, he sent sort of, militia, later than necessary by the time all the damage was done. So it was a way of, so to speak, popular justice in quotes, in a sense that people, Muslims were aggravated. They thought Armenians were leaving the empire and then they stormed the Armenian neighborhoods and massacred people. Of course, they could because Muslims had also the right to bear arms, and non-Muslims did not. And that meant that if you look at the figures, the Armenian deaths are usually anywhere from 3 to 10 times the deaths of Muslims in these times of conflict. But what's very important is that this sort of happens all over, and it is not systematic. I mean, it is not systematic in the sense that the intent doesn't seem to kill. The intent seems to be to punish by the Sultan, and he punishes basically by sending things too late and then therefore letting, popular justice take its course. But what's very important is at the end of these massacres, people who engage in all these murders were not held accountable for their murders. That is what's important, and that sort of, I think, creates the ground for what happens later on.
So then given that, how is this violence interpreted and remembered by the authors of the memoirs you look at and the people at the time?
Well, that was the most fascinating thing, was that when I looked, of course, it could be understandable that most of the Ottoman officials and officers and, most of the people or intellectuals, people who wrote the memoirs, mostly lived at the capital. Because they lived at the capital, or at least, they traveled to other parts but ended up there, at the capital, people had no idea about what was going on in the provinces. Huh. I mean, they probably heard about it and read about it. But most importantly, I think, it is the Ottoman bank, takeover that is very important. Takeover by the Armenian revolutionaries. They took over the bank in 1896, and they did so in order to draw attention to what was going on the East. And then, of course, here is a sultan who has like absolute, control over everything, and then suddenly this group of, revolutionaries pull this off, take over the bank, and, that took everybody by surprise, because what happened was that, of course, there were bombs that exploded. They heard that, and then there were some revolutionaries who escaped from the bank, and then they were all over the city with the soldiers after them. You see in a lot of memoirs people realizing for the first time, oh my God, what was that explosion? Huh. Who is and some of them describe seeing a street fight between one of the revolutionaries and others, and and for the first time, they are aware that there is an Armenian issue. And of course, the first denial that sets in sort of is triggered by this event, because the Sultan doesn't give in, but says that the revolutionaries could leave the empire. So what happens is that they are accompanied by the director of the bank, who takes them to his yacht, and the yacht then sails to France, so that they too get away with what they've done without being punished. And in addition, the Sultan then uses this to have the first denial, and the first denial is the Sultan says, "See, it was always the Western forces, people outside of Europe, who had instigated this, instigated this Armenian problem, and because of that, when things didn't work out, they took their people, their puppets, Armenian puppets, back to Europe." In a way, it was a very good way of totally denying the fact that the origins of the violence or the Armenian issue were actually the failure of the reforms in Turkey from 1839 to 76, failure to contain the violence. So it was a domestically, produced problem. And so first denial was that it was instigated by the great powers and by powers outside of Turkey. And this is, of course, something that goes on in Turkey to this day. Whenever something happens in Turkey, people seem to immediately find I want to claim outside the country, which of course is a good way of projecting and turning attention away from internal strife. So that's what happens in the first stage.
And then if that leads us, of course, to the period of the genocide, in which the Committee of Union and Progress is essentially in control of the government. And we don't have a lot of time to go into a lot of depth and background. Could you briefly, for those listeners who aren't familiar with this, briefly kind of summarize what the Committee on Union and Progress wanted and how it moved to try and force a social structure of similarity on the empire?
Yeah. Well, that is where you have the committee is called Union and Progress. These are the first graduates of the Western style schools, Western style education that got started in the empire. And that education was Western style because they were trying to catch up with what was going on in the West, of course. And through that education, they became, sort of open to ideas of liberty, of progress, of making the empire better. And as a consequence, the Sultan provided them with this education, hoping that their loyalty to the Sultan would increase. Instead, they became loyal to each other and decided that what was needed definitely was a constitution, an assembly, and they were intent on basically replacing the Sultan rather than being loyal to him. And that is how they took these ideas of sort of Western modernity and tried to systematically apply it to the empire. So they rebelled against the Sultan, the Young Turks did, and then the Sultan had to give in and bring back the constitution, which he had put on hold. And once they came to power, they had no way, the Young Turks, mostly officials and officers, had no way of controlling society, and they themselves started to resort to violence. The first against the opponents of the regime, the journalists. So there were lots of assassinations of people who took a stand against them. And then what happened, of course, was through a series of the Balkan Wars was a big disaster where the Ottoman Empire lost. Then came the First World War, and there was a huge defeat in the Russian front. And you could see systematically those Young Turks in the party that had very radical views and also at this time increasingly nationalistic views of making at least sure that Sunni Muslim Turks would be in positions of power to sustain the empire. They decided that Anatolia, Asia Minor, was going to be their homeland, and all those, who called the same place their ancestral lands had to be systematically eliminated. And the most important, of course, indigenous people of the region were the Armenians, and that is when the systematic destruction of the Armenians started all over the empire. It was systematic in terms of the Ottoman administration was concerned, but in application there were a lot of variations because, of course, not a lot of people went along with it, and who did not go along and opposed were usually removed and replaced, and as a consequence, they were forced out of their houses, the places they had lived for centuries, sent on a death march, and, as a consequence of which, according to the Ottoman official figures, 800,000 or unofficial ones, 1.5 million Armenians perished in the process. And what is interesting there is the denial that I'm interested in, that even though this is, of course, destruction, usually it happened outside of the cities, outside of other people's, ability to watch and witness it. They said, no, these were just sort of adverse consequences of deportations, forceful sort of deportations away from areas considered militarily sort of significant. So that was the second denial, was the denial of the act itself, even though this was an act intent for destruction. It was seen as a sort of, a non-destructive act. So then...
go ahead, sorry. you said they. To what degree is this... Is the denial intentional and centralized as opposed to decentralized and incidental or accidental?
I think it is both. It is very interesting. Of course, Young Turks would not have been able to carry this out if they did not have local people who went along with them. And if you do look, Young Turks, İttihat ve Terakki, as we say in Turkish Union and Progress, they established clubs all over the empire locally. And these were always almost exclusively headed by Muslims and Muslim Turks. So these, they were called responsible clerks in all these local areas, were very important in working together with either the governor or, the sub-governor in carrying these out. So there was definitely local, collaboration. In addition, there were, of course, others, other local notables who were more than happy to, take over and plunder the wealth and property of people who were going and being destroyed. So, I don't know if you call that accidental, but they put their interests before their ethics, or at least most of them did. We know of instances where people refused to have anything to do with it. So it was a very mixed picture, but there is no doubt that there was collaboration on the most part at the local level in what was going on. Otherwise, it could not have been carried to this degree. Although there was also resistance, and we have to probably recognize the resistance because those were the righteous. And, those at least will give us a hope going to the future for reconciliation, to recognize those people.
What happens to the perpetrators in the immediate post-war period, and how does that shape shape the emergence of denial in the post-war period?
What happens basically is that the leading triumvirate, Cemal Pasha, Talat Pasha, and Enver Pasha, and some of the sort of major ones escape to Germany. So they are tried in absentia for the violence they perpetrated. So they are gone. The rest of them, though, stay, of course, in the empire. Some of them, because the British, especially, are intent on bringing them to justice. A lot of them try, to escape. Those who cannot escape are imprisoned. But because there is so much nationalistic fervor about the imprisonment, the British then exiled them to the island of Malta, so they are at least for a year or two out of action. What happens is that those who are left in the country basically organize first into sort of defense units against the British occupation in the aftermath of the war, a British and French occupation, and Italian, but British is the main one. And then what these then turn into, defense units are headed by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who himself was not involved in these massacres. Then the perpetrators are left with a choice. They can either join Atatürk in this independence war, they have no idea where it's leading, or they can, go and face British, justice, whatever that may bring. And, it doesn't look good because they've had, one or two people. So a lot of them throw their lots in with the independence movement and join the independence movement. And, of course, Mustafa Kemal at the time needs skilled people who could help him fight the war. And the perpetrators are all officials and officers who are skilled, who have, you know, skills that could that he could benefit from. And once the war succeeds, the former perpetrators then become the heroes of the Republic, and it becomes extremely difficult to punish them after that. So not only are there, violence they committed forgiven, but they are actually then, their past is whitewashed, and they start leading, you know, becoming very important figures in the Turkish Republic, prime ministers, ministers, and the like. And by doing that, of course, you let the violence, the unaccounted violence that he said people had perpetrated, you know, diffuse into the Turkish Republican time, continuing the violence not to the same degree against the non-Muslims, not to the same degree as before, but now mostly in the form of pogroms, you know, and plunder of their wealth, which is what I focus on in the third period. I cannot hear you.
One of the really interesting parts of the book mm-hmm. is that many of the studies about Armenia or about the genocide end in 1917 or 1919 or whatever, and you pursue this to talk about how there's maybe not a culture of violence, but a continuation of violence against non-Turkish minorities during the Republic. Why does that happen?
Well, partially because I think it's a number of factors. One, as I said, the people, the perpetrators, are now in positions of decision-making and power. And because they have benefited themselves from the violence that they had committed against the minorities, the pattern of then aggressing upon minorities continues. And of course, there are some very few minorities left in the Republic. These are mostly concentrated in the cities. They are mostly in the now the western parts, because the eastern parts are pretty much decimated. And there they still control, they have wealth, some wealth somehow, because these are the apolitical ones. And rather than, you know, trying to figure out how to put up with especially the adversities of Second World War, even though Turkey does not enter the Second World War, it nevertheless has to mobilize, and it becomes increasingly difficult in wartime conditions to come up with some money, you know, with funds. And of course, it should be noted that most of these officials and officers have never, have not been business people. They have not, they do not know how to make money. They usually know how to manage in the case of the officials, or spend money in the case of the officers. So they say they're looking, you know, where to find money, and they decide to tax unfairly the non-Muslims to a degree that a lot of them cannot pay the taxes and perish in labor battalions. And then they decide to all, you know, right before that, take them into the military and make them, you know, serve there. And after that, have this tax put in, and then they literally take a lot of money away from them. And when this doesn't work out, then they use the occasion of the problems Turkey is having with Cyprus to again, you know, to sort of get the West to pay attention and sort of frighten others. They go after and plunder the wealth of non-Muslim minorities in 1955, what we call as the 6-7 September events. So what's happening there is in the Turkish Republic, not everybody is protected equally by the law. And those who are not seen as, you know, proper Turkish citizens, over time this happens. Basically, those who are not Sunni Muslim Turks are the ones who increasingly face violence. And that is, you know, why the Armenians face violence, mostly through legal means. You know, the intent is to, like, get rid of them one way or the other, through attrition, you know, through confiscating their property. And they do manage, you know, because they were about 20% of the population in the 1890s, and then it's now 0.02%, if that now. So that demonstrates that it was systematic, using institutions, military, in the military, people have these horrid stories of, you know, what happens if you're a non-Muslim because you have to serve in the military. So in any possible way, what happens, of course, is most of the generations then don't want their children to stay there. I mean, and, you know, the children migrate. So that's how it sort of continues. Then we hit the last stage.
Mm-hmm. And you say, you suggest that this last stage of denial in the later Republic years are triggered by a series of assassinations of Turkish officials. Can you talk about that and explain how that leads the Turkish state to develop an official discourse of denial? And here I'm stealing your words, but that's probably okay.
Well, in the 1970s, there is a lot of unrest throughout the world. And as a part of this sort of unrest, terrorism, you know, that especially is sort of, you know, is advocated around the of course, the Palestinian cause and other causes, third world causes, so to speak, also leads some Armenians, younger Armenians, to decide to engage in violence and terror as a way to once again draw attention to what happened in the genocide, because the problem is, of course, with past violence, if you do not acknowledge it, and deny it, as the Turkish state and society did and do at that point, the wounds never heal. And then, therefore, they're always with you. I mean, like a nightmare that never goes away. So in order to call attention, they decide to assassinate Turkish diplomats who are serving mostly in Europe or in the United States. And the assassination starts. At the time, the Turkish state has no idea what's happening and why it's happening. They think it's either the West, you know, it's either the Soviet Union or the United States or someone behind them. Then they eventually realize that it's the justice commandos of the Armenian genocide or the Armenian secret army for the liberation of Armenia. So ASALA or JCOAG, as we say. So these terrorists take a total of, you know, I think 30, 40 diplomats. And during this time, the Turkish state, which had considered this a complete done issue, it's, you know, mm-hmm. are suddenly have to understand and explain to their populace and also to the rest of the world what's happening. They look and they do not have any literature on it in English. They just have one little brochure when the first assassination occurs in 1974. So they say okay. They invite, according to Kamran Gürün's, Turkish officials' memoirs, they invite the scholars to Ankara and they say to all these professors, they say, well, this is what you should be doing. You should start looking to our history and demonstrate how terrible the Armenians have been all through. And Kamran Gürün says, not only did these scholars at all listen to what we had to say, they had the alacrity to tell us what to do and how to do it instead. Because, of course, a lot of them probably said, that's not how you do research and, you know, academic mm-hmm. research. So basically, they don't do anything and they go back to their universities. And Kamran Gürün is desperate. Who should he, recruit for his cause? He recruits retired diplomats, who are officials, and he sends them all. I mean, they are also, of course, no Ottoman Turkish, so it's easy because they're of a generation that moved from the Republic from the Empire to the Republic. So they go in and they start systematically going through whatever material there is, with the intent to demonstrate, how the Armenians were violent and, all along. Therefore, they come up with a rhetorical account of what is now the official history, where they deny, basically, at that point, they deny any responsibility for what happened, saying that Armenians also killed Turks, that these massacres were mutual, and that is how the rhetoric comes about, is sort of brought up mostly by these retired diplomats. But of course, recently, ever since the end of the Cold War and the reorganization of the world order, there is now, for the first time in Turkey, a public sphere where these things have started to be discussed. So in the last, since 1990s, probably in the last 10 to 15 years, there has been a dramatic difference in the denial, in the sense that there was one survey done, and now 9% of Turks think that there was a genocide. Mm-hmm. 9% is minimal, but it is better than, I guess, 0%. And I'm sure generationally, with each generation, it will go up, especially since people are now much more cognizant of the violence that the Turkish state keeps perpetrating against all groups, I think because of this tradition of violence.
Well, your conclusion to the book is unusual for an academic work. And in it, you talk about the purpose of writing the book, that the book is really aimed at the perpetrators of violence and denial. What do you hope to accomplish with that?
Well, you see, this is why it was so contentious all along. When I was, because I initially did not want to use the word genocide, because not because of what happened was not genocide, it was. But I said Turkish state and society, especially Turkish society, has no clue about what happened in their own past. They do not know their own history. And you can't ask people to accept the violence they know nothing about, if you don't educate them first, or at least tell about it to them first. And that's why I said, usually I will call it a genocide, when the Turkish state society become aware of what happened and call it a genocide with me. So that was like my sort of public intellectual, I guess, role in a certain way. That is why I wanted, because I myself was brought up in Turkey, got the best education I did. I had no clue about the genocide myself. We have, because our history textbooks are so whitewashed, in it, the Turks are always virtuous and innocent, and everybody else is naughty and, they are the ones committing the violence, and they're always portrayed in a negative way. If I didn't know this history, and nobody else does either, I thought they should first know what was going on. And then, and once I wrote the book, then I figured, hopefully now it's being translated into Turkish too, they will see it, read it, and then that's why I didn't even want to have a conclusion. And then I had to, go back and forth with my editor. They said, look, I said, no, I want to write the conclusion when actually genocide is acknowledged in Turkey. They said, no, you can't do that. At least then put in the conclusion what it is that you want. Mm-hmm. That's why it's a very short conclusion, just to say, this is an ongoing saga.
So it's a pretty new book, and you just mentioned that it's been translated. How's it been received?
Well, interestingly enough, it came out in November, and I was in Turkey, and it came right as the Turkish History Foundation, Tarih Vakfı, is having this whole year, I think about 15 talks, on the Armenian genocide. And they said to me, well, would you like to be the first one to start off the series? I said, sure, why not? I mean, that meant I gave the first talk after the book came out in Turkey, in Turkish. So I actually had the book. I showed it to them because only one copy. That was the only copy. It wasn't out in print yet. And there were about 120 people. I gave it. They also have it on a podcast on their site in Turkey. Everybody listened. They all were fine with it. They asked intelligent, important questions about it the way you did. So it was, at least in that audio medium, very positively received. Mm. Of course, I also have no problems with it when I give it, you know, in the United States, in Europe sometimes, but there are occasionally there are people from the embassy who come to sort of play the devil's advocate and, you know, tell me that I'm ignorant and don't start talking about it. But aside from that, it has been so far well received. But I think it will probably take another 6 months, you know, to a year for people to go through because it's a big book too.
Mm-hmm.
It's 644 pages, and you know, we'll see how it is. I hope that it will contribute to the world being a better place. It's dedicated to my children and Hrant Dink's grandchildren, because Hrant Dink was a friend whose loss, I think, has traumatized our generation of intellectuals in Turkey. And I say that hopefully they will live in a world that is more peaceful and respectful of people than ours has been.
You mentioned that you didn't know anything about this growing up. What has it been like for you to research and write this book?
Well, I have made a lot of new friends and I have lost a lot of old friends. So it has been trial by fire, which was interesting because this was a question I asked, you know, and I thought this was the way a way for Turkey to come to terms with its past and become a more democratic, accepting society. I asked the question about the foundation of violence, and obviously it was the wrong question to ask because a lot of people took issue with me, and a lot of people were very upset that I would put academic interests, whatever they would be, before state interest. And I would get emails saying, what kind of a Turk are you? You know, shame on you. What are you doing? I mean, you know, you can't do this to your own people. I mean, so obviously some thought I was being a traitor in Turkey. Likewise, though, I mean, here as I was giving the talks initially, Armenians too were like very upset because they for a very long time thought that I was an agent of the Turkish state somehow, tend to like, you know, pull things apart here and, you know, and they also thought that a Turk couldn't be as civilized as I was, so obviously I must have been Armenian. So it was, you realize that the radicals on both sides were exactly that. I mean, Turks said my blood must be tainted, obviously, and therefore I was saying the insane things I was saying against the Turkish state. The Armenians said, yes, my blood must be civilized, you know, by some Armenian blood, because I wouldn't be the Turk saying the civilized things I was saying if it wasn't so. So I left that aside and, you know, moved on. And, you know, I had a chance to at least surround myself and draw strength from people who are like me, who think like me. And, you know, especially at the University of Michigan and also through WATS, Workshop on Armenian-Turkish. We have a scholarship. I mean, we have a scholarship, I mean, a workshop series that continues for a long time. Through those, I was able to, you know, and with our students, who now we make sure they know both Turkish and Armenian, Ottoman and Armenian when they're doing work, I think we are trying to create a new generation, a new body of knowledge, you know, where all parties bring in what they have and are respected to the same degree. So we'll see where it goes. And what will I be doing next? People ask. Now I want to learn Kurdish and study the Kurds, because after the Armenians, the same violence gets applied to the Kurds. And that is, of course, another problem we have in Turkey today, much to the distress of my family, because they said, you know, we thought you'd, you know, choose something safer. They say, do the gardens, the parks, you know, something positive. Why do the Kurds? And I say, well, this is what sociologists do. We go after, you know, problems.
Well, we've taken a lot of your time. I'd just like to ask you one more question. And it's a question I ask everybody. And I'd like to give you a chance for the listeners in our audience who are interested in going further, what's one book or one movie or what would you recommend they go read to learn more?
Well, there's so much that has been written most recently. I mean, in the last 10 years, of course, we've always had works by Armenian scholars like Rüştü Tovanesyan and others. Now there are, of course, other Turkish scholars, Taner Akçam or Ümit İngör, and Lerna Ekmekçioğlu is just coming out with a book. We have others who are also coming out. And probably the one I've read the most recently is my colleague here, Ronald Grigorsuni, is also putting out a book, I think it's already out, called The Armenian Genocide. And it is it really does summarize the whole thing, and, you know, in a way that is very deep and thoughtful. So that probably would be the one that would really give people a picture of the entire thing.
Well, as I said to you as we were chatting before the interview, it's a wonderful book, and I hope the listeners will go and get it and read it and think about the arguments you make. And that you'll come back with us on the show after you're done studying the Kurds, assuming your family doesn't disown you.
Maybe in another 10 years.
Well,
they're still here.
More fear in the hearts of graduate students. But thank you so much for being on the show, and hopefully we'll talk to you again sometime.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to an interview with Fatma Muge Gucek about her book, Denial of Violence, Ottoman Past, Turkish Present, and Collective Violence Against the Armenians, 1789 to 2009. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time when I'll talk with Jürgen Matthias about the book, War, Pacification, and Mass Murder, 1939. The Einsatzgruppen in Poland. Until then, thanks for the download, and have a great month.